Colleen, you've convinced me at least that this is not just a bad probe, but at the same time, you're going to go to Minot. So for these pilots who lack all of your experience and wisdom about maintenance and aircraft engines, they sense something's wrong. They probably don't really know what's wrong. Why not land right now?
Even though the indications don't look right, they're not trending worse. The key thing here is the CHT. The cylinder is healthy, it's running fine, there's no roughness, there's no change in any of the parameters, fuel flow. You don't see CHT increasing. You just see that EGT indication. The EGT indicates that something is going wrong, but it's not moving fast. It's just different than the others. We try to tell people not to look at the absolute value of the EGT, but look at changes in EGT. So the real question is how long has it been like this? And we actually don't know because the pilot wasn't making a practice of watching the engine monitor page. But for me, if I were a student pilot with not much knowledge, I would probably assume that it was an incorrect indication from a sensor and then just go with, you know, the butt technique of, do I feel roughness in my butt? You know, is the engine not running properly? Based on that, I would think I have extra time, but something isn't right, and I would want it looked at properly. And the best place to do that is at Minot.
How much do you put in engine roughness? Because obviously the worst-case scenario here is what goes from smooth to quitting instantly. So what are the other things I should be looking for that signal this is going bad faster than I thought, other than the roughness part?
Well, I mean, the CHT is really going to tell you if that cylinder is about to execute itself. It does get rough, you know, and I would be sensing that. But a lot of times you think you feel something, but it's just your spidey sense is working overtime and it's not really rough. You know, like whenever you go over water, immediately the engine feels rough, but it's probably not. That's why I like engine monitors, because it's data and it's cross-checking your intuitions. And if I look at the CHT and I see everything is stable in the engine, I wouldn't hesitate to fly it for a little bit longer, but I would want to get it checked out.
So nobody here picked one, which is land now. I assume because of the lack of facilities, the cold weather, we're not sure that that's really going to help anything. Dave, you went with two, continuing on to Williston. So walk us through your thinking.
Right. I went with number two for some of the reasons that Colleen just mentioned. Engine's running smooth. You don't see any changes. CHT is the really vital reading, and it's healthy. I think there are a couple of things to look at. We haven't talked about whether this plane has a CO sensor, you know. So it's like if we're concerned about, you know, a cracked exhaust, and this is cold temperature, we got to have that heat on. Is it showing up in a CO sensor? And, you know, that would be a obvious, you know, land now, you know, emergency sort of situation, or at least get some more ventilation. And what I would be tempted to do is make some changes, enrich the mixture, reduce the power. You know, the Lycoming guidance is that you can't hurt the engine by leaning if you're in a normally aspirated engine, if you're above 7,500 feet. You're almost there in this case. But, you know, if you were to reduce the engine power to 65% or less, theoretically, you couldn't hurt it by too lean a mixture. And I believe the EGT, you know, I believe the sensor. It's too convenient to just disregard that information because, oh, the sensor's broken. You know, it's like, hey, look, that's lazy and it's easy and it's tempting, but, you know, let's not go there. But by making the mixture richer, reducing power, see if that brings down the EGT, and continue on to Williston, not because of anything that's going to go in your logbook. With a potential engine problem in a single engine airplane over the tundra approaching night, you know, I'm not concerned about, you know, making the cross-country entry in my logbook, but I don't think it's unreasonable to continue given that all other indications are fine.
Kevin.
I got to argue one point, and that's the 7,500-foot thing. I think that is probably a good rule of thumb, but I'm pretty sure we're talking about density altitude. And with it being as cold as it is, I'll bet we're a whole lot lower than that for density altitude.
Now, Kevin, you're going to turn around and go back home. So that's going to be over an hour headed back home, just for some context here. Minot, about 18 minutes away. Williston, about 41 minutes away. You're going to take the longest route, but it's going to get you back to home base. Why are you comfortable with that hour flight?
I think that there's something going on with the engine that I'm not thrilled with, but I don't think it's catastrophic, and I think we're going to be okay for a while, but I'm taking my ball and I'm going home. Just because something seems off and I don't know if it's going to get worse. So I think heading home is a safe option, because I think all the indications are that the engine's still doing okay, but it's probably going to need some attention. And I think home is probably the best place to get that done.
Wally, you went with four, so you're going to go to Minot, but you're not going to mess around with circling. You're just going to get on the ground. Tell us why.
Because, one, I'm not able to analyze that situation as well as Colleen just did. But by seeing what we have, I believe that we have an engine problem of some kind. And I think it's more important to say, let's deal with the engine problem in the safest way rather than put that cross-country thing on the back burner for now. Another reason is it's late in the afternoon, and we want to get to Minot before the mechanic goes home. Because if we get there and they're gone, we may or may not get a call out. If we get there quickly, he can get it in the hangar, he can take a look. He may say, go ahead and proceed, and we can salvage the night cross country. But I don't want to be out over North Dakota in the wintertime with any question about that airplane, because I used to live up there. I know. It's deadly.
Now, Brett, I want to get your perspective. You work a lot with a very busy flight school with lots of 172s that have G1000s and lots of students who probably don't really know what the engine monitoring system looks like or how it works. So where you come down on this?
Yeah, that's right. And these pilots don't either. So on the main screen of the G1000, it shows the hottest EGT on the hottest cylinder on the main strip there. And these pilots missed that. That was pegged all the way at the max. So they went to the engine monitoring screen for a completely different purpose, but then notice the pegged number three cylinder. It's worth pointing out here, too, that 1650 is the max EGT that instrumentation will even show. So it could be way higher than that. And as Colleen mentioned, it's not an absolute, but we're at the extreme values here. And the airplanes I fly, I see, you know, ranges plus or minus 200 all the time on a carbureted engine, which has a lot more variation. But this is fuel injected, so we expect a little more stability there. So I actually came to the same conclusion as Colleen before even reading her response. I'm going to stay at altitude, again, given these pilot circumstances, not knowing the engine, stay at altitude, fly to Minot, and do the exact thing she mentioned. I'm going to start doing some mag checks. I'm going to mess with the mixture, adjust power settings. But as I do that, I'm going to have my cell phone out and take pictures also. I'm going to document that. And as she mentioned, there is the data logging on the G1000, assuming that the shop at Minot knows how to pull that off of there. But take pictures of what you're seeing and what you're doing to document it, maybe take a video. And to Wally's point, I'm going to get on the cell phone. Hopefully I have coverage and call down on the ground while I'm doing that as well, just to preclude maybe if that mechanic is leaving. But use all the resources you have. Play it safe. Last thing I'll point out, make sure glide range ring is turned on the G1000. Again, we don't know what's going to happen here. We're assuming catastrophic failure is not imminent, but have all your resources ready just in case it does.
Yeah, great point about using the glide range ring. This is a place where that can at least give you some peace of mind, if nothing else. David.
I think we should go back to first principles, and this is an instructional flight, students. So you think you have an engine problem, so there's three choices: land immediately, land as soon as practicable, or you determine that the engine problem is not significantly reducing the safety of this flight and you carry on. So that's why I chose four. It's not the engine oil temperature, oil pressure, and the engine condition, smoothness, doesn't indicate anything right now immediately wrong. So I don't think the land immediately is required, but there's something wrong, and engines don't fix themselves. So this is a land as soon as practicable, and practicable is not just you, it's the where you're going, maintenance facilities, hotel, all the other stuff, right? And so Minot seems to be quite a good choice. It has all the things you want. But when I get there, I'm going to land. First of all, if there is an issue with the engine and it's significant, 22 minutes could be the difference between an easy repair or a destroyed engine. And then the second part is what Ollie said, it's starting to get dark. And so let's get on the ground while we can still see what's going on. Because it would really suck if you're at minute 21:59 and the engine calves, and now it's kind of dark, and now we're doing a forced approach. So, but I think the takeaway to me is that organized planning. Like, let's not just zoom down to the rabbit holes of what the gauge has said. Let's ask the big picture questions. Land now, land as soon as practical, or no, this does not. There's no evidence that this will materially reduce the safety of this flight. If you ask yourself those three questions right off the bat, I think that will help provide some clarity for decision making.
Yeah, that's a great way to think about this, of putting these options in buckets. And it seems like what I'm hearing from the group is there's sort of different levels of diagnosing the engine, and there's just the physical feel. Is it rough or smooth? Is it running? And then it seems like, David, you're sort of prioritizing oil pressure, oil temperature, maybe slightly above raw EGT as a value. And then we get down to that. So, Colleen, go back to you with all of your expertise on this. Is that fair that when I'm trying to diagnose, let's say I've diverted somewhere and I'm trying to figure out what's going on, are you running through sort of a this is level one, level two, level three? Or what do you think, especially a newer pilot like this, what should they be focusing on there as they divert?
Well, I would think a newer pilot would just be plain nervous, you know, and I don't like flying nervous. So if I were a newer pilot and I saw that and I didn't understand what it was, I probably would just land. I'm trying to second guess the pilot because he's invested a lot of time and money into this. And what I'm trying to do is impress upon people that airborne troubleshooting can really help the people on the ground. Just showing up and saying something looked wrong to a mechanic or the engine ran rough is the worst thing we ever hear, because the mechanic has no way of duplicating that. And then you're just asking him to start exploring your engine because he doesn't even know where to start. So I like the thought of giving data to the mechanic. I will say that if you make, there are certain situations where if you make a change to power or a mixture or something, you could precipitate an issue with the engine. So if something's not right with the engine, I tend to not like to change the controls until I'm in a safe place to land. So that's one thing that promotes doing the airborne troubleshooting over the airport as opposed to en route to the airport. The other thing I'd like to point out is that not all valve failures result in catastrophic engine failure. Just because a piece of the valve might break off, it doesn't really have a lot of places to go. It might bounce around in the cylinder. It might get it's usually spit out into the exhaust. Sometimes it goes into the induction system, but it has a long way to travel to get to places where it can really damage things. So it's not an automatic, you know, engine teardown if you lose a valve. The other thing is that this might not be a burned valve. It could be a valve with some junk in it. A valve is like a stopper at the bottom of your sink. You know, when you put that stopper down, you want to fill the sink up with water. That's what we're doing when we get combustion in the cylinder. We're closing the cylinder, sealing it up so you can squeeze that gas-air mixture and then ignite it. If there's something blocking that valve or holding the valve off its seat, and it's often carbon, that will prevent the valve from sealing properly, and you'll get leakage past it. That's a pretty big leak to generate this kind of EGT, but situations like that sometimes do correct themselves. I look at valve data a lot, and I'm the person that has to send out an alert to somebody, hey, something's wrong with your valve. And more often than not, if I look at, we had an alert on a valve, and I look a couple flights later, and it corrects itself. But you don't know that here. That's why I'm trying to exercise the caution to go, you know, and have it checked out.
Kevin, we're going to go to the ATC angle here. If I'm diverting, am I declaring an emergency? Am I telling ATC anything, or am I just changing my destination? Let's assume I've got flight following here, which I think we'd agree is a smart idea over very cold, hostile terrain. So what do I tell ATC?
I guess it depends on what you want for a response from them. If you declare an emergency, then they're going to be asking fuel, souls, what are your intentions? If you say where you're diverting to, probably that's going to initiate a rescue response out there. Probably you'll have fire trucks and ambulances waiting for you. So I think really the question is, do you want that level of response from ATC? If you do, for whatever reason, then great. If you don't, then I think just changing your destination is an easy way to do that.
How about the level of training these pilots, and frankly, even the instructor probably has, in terms of engine management? It's not typically a part that's covered in most primary training or even advanced training curriculums. As we see in this scenario, the pilots have never even used the lean assist page. What's a good way to get a newer pilot into the guts of an engine analyzer and start to understand what normal looks like? Because I think a lot of what we're talking about here is, we've mentioned here, they missed that the fact that this EGT has been pegged, who knows how long. It's not a limitation. There's no green arc here that they can notice, but they missed the fact that this wasn't normal. So what are some ways that a new pilot can get comfortable with using a multi-point engine analyzer? Brett, what do you see in the flight school? I mean, how do you get somebody's feet wet in this world?
Sure, and it should be introduced really at the very beginning at the run-up, right? That's a good time to check out your cylinder behavior, your, like Colleen mentioned, valve behavior, spark plugs, right? We're checking that combustion's happening properly. So start to build that awareness, just like we know on climb out. We look for normal airspeed, normal power settings. On the run-up, we should look for certain parameters in the exhaust gas temperature. And we're looking for even rise, obviously, on the mag check, making sure that we're not having any spark plugs drop out during that point. But also, it might be a good idea on climb-out, just like we do with the higher performance engines, that we have a JPI engine monitor or a Garmin engine monitor that's always on, to have that screen up and keep an eye on it. Not stare at it, but just reference it during climb-out to know at the max power setting what the normal indications are during cruise, obviously. Because my guess here is this plane could have been operated this way for many, many hours and no one noticed it. So if the flight school standardization, the students are prepared for that, when something is out of the ordinary, then they know what to expect. But in this case, again, I have the feeling it's been this way for quite a long time.
David.
Yeah, I think Brett raised a really good point. What I see a lot of is run up by rote, like just this mindlessly following the checklist without understanding why you're doing something. And even at the instructor level, I see that a lot. And so what Brett was talking about, I think, is a really important piece. What are we looking for and why? And what is normal and what is not normal? And I think that should be introduced pretty early in the game. So both of these pilots really are missing a fairly important chunk of instruction, quite a bit earlier in their career, because it seemed neither one really knew what they were doing. A second part I'd like to raise is, if what I see, particularly with more private pilots, is they have these gauges and then it does something weird and say, oh, the gauge is broken. And I had a fellow I know with a pressurized Skymaster, and he was flying home and the CHT and EGT on a cylinder spiked. And he was right over like a big GA airport. And he said, oh, well, last year the probe failed and, oh, the stupid gauges. So he flies 2 hours home and tells a mechanic to fix the gauge, which he did by replacing the cylinder.
Well, if he's got a Turbo Skymaster, his judgment is already in question.
Okay, I'll acknowledge that.
Not going to touch that, Wally.
Well, I just want to add to what Brett and David said about training, your question, training. Not only introducing the equipment early, but that training also needs to include a couple of tours through the hangar, looking at engines and airplanes with cowling off and identifying a cylinder and a spark plug and a probe and all the things. And that's not just lesson one, but as you start them, you can bring them back and tie in what we're doing with the run-up and tie in what we're doing with some maybe engine analysis and show them the hardware that's there.
Also a great chance when you transition to an airplane, maybe with an EG or multi-point monitor glass cockpit, if you learn on steam gauges with less instrumentation. I see a lot of pilots there who just know, I went to one mag and the RPM dropped, so I guess it's good. Whereas you point out, Colleen, 50 degrees rise in EGT, that a lot of people aren't looking for that if they're not used to flying with glass cockpits like this. Dave?
That's an excellent point for understanding the why behind the things that we do that are on the checklist. And that brings me to the instructor in this case. And I'm just kind of curious, I guess it's unanswered so far, as to, is the instructor really just letting the student make the decision? And is CFI really that passive? What's the CFI's next move? I'm really curious about that in this scenario, because the CFI may have a really good grasp of this situation and a plan for it. We just don't know it yet. So I'm curious, as a CFI and somebody who closely observes other CFIs, that would be something of great interest in this scenario.
Colleen?
Back to the mag check. Whenever I do a mag check, I was taught to listen to RPM. I don't even look at RPM now. I mean, I'm feeling it, but I'm watching all the EGTs. And if I don't see an EGT rise, I know that that spark plug isn't firing. That's what it's telling you. You know, when you go to a single mag, you're exercising one spark plug per cylinder, and the EGTs must rise because that's not as efficient. So a lot of that fuel-air mixture is going out the exhaust. That's what you should see. If you don't see an EGT rise on every cylinder, it means that one of those spark plugs is weak. Now, that doesn't mean you can't go. It might mean you need to clear a plug, right? So you might try a high-power run-up just to try to get that plug clear and then try that check again. But you should be looking that for that every time you take off. And they would have seen this EGT higher on the run-up if they've been looking at the EGTs, but they were probably looking at the RPM gauge.
So there's this whole discussion here that's been very helpful about diagnosing the problem, understanding the engine gauges. It does seem, today's point, this is a slightly different situation in that it's a flight school airplane, it's a rental, it's a flight instructor. I suspect many people around this round table would behave differently if it was their airplane that they owned and maybe they knew what normal was. Is anybody's diversion planning different here because it's a dual flight in a flight school airplane versus if it was your own airplane you owned? Would anybody change their mind if this was you? I'm seeing not many.
Not given the conditions in North Dakota at the time we're flying. I frankly, I probably would change my mind and proceed on to the destination if I was in a warmer climate.
So that's a big deal. So staying on that point, Wally, what are some things these pilots should hopefully have thought through from a survival standpoint, even though we're not expecting to land out? What are some things they should have prepared for?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, survival, if they have a forced landing in this situation, and that could happen whether there's an EGT problem or not, that can happen anytime. They certainly should have had survival-type clothing and sat phone or whatever they might need for communication out there, because you're not going to last long in North Dakota with these temperatures and what, 26 knots of wind or 28 knots of wind. You're going to need to be rescued pretty quickly on that cross country. I did a lot of cross countries in very cold weather in Minnesota and was totally unprepared as I think back on it now.
Probably also part of diversion planning as you're planning this cross country is, where am I going to go if I have a problem? And this gets to the discussion about not just airports, but mechanics and warm hangars and hotels and all that. So, David, let's say you land and we're at Minot and we call back to the home base. What's that interaction look like? Let's say you're the flight school owner or the flight school manager. What are you going to tell this student to do? Haul it into the shop, or this is no big deal? What's that interaction go like?
Well, if you say no big deal from 100 miles away, you should be fired on the spot. But this actually leads into kind of what I was just thinking about, and that is the dirty little secret of flight schools and instructors living with broken airplanes. And I see that a lot. And because if the airplane is, you know, it breaks on the first flight of the day, they got five flights scheduled, the temptation is to just kind of let it go with the flow. And so that is a terrible message to students. And that, I've seen several instances where people continued with quite serious issues with the airplane because they didn't want to be the guy that grounded the airplane. And there was a case when I was an instructor full-time where there was a Cessna 150 and the mags had been badly timed, like badly. So the engine was developing much less power than it should have. And it had gone for weeks, and then I happened to fly it, and it was obvious it wasn't making power. And so I snag it, and the comment from the dispatcher is, oh yeah, the other instructors are complaining that airplane was really doggy for the last 3 weeks. So there is a duty of care on the part of instructors to demonstrate good ADM by refusing to take broken airplanes and by dealing with in-flight anomalies properly. And I think this is a really good example where this is good ADM for the prospective commercial pilot. Hey, we got a problem with the airplanes. We're going to proactively deal with it. And that includes how to get the airplane attended to so we can carry on with the operation.
Yeah, that reminds me of the most dangerous words you can hear from a flight instructor or mechanic when you say, oh, it always looks like that, right? That, and I have a little concern from today's point on what the flight instructor is doing here, that there may be a little bit of plan continuation bias here. Oh, that's always wrong. Those EGT gauges always look like that. And that's where I think, Brett, it puts a student in a difficult situation here that they may not know what normal is. Is there a way, though, as a student to get a little more involved in maybe not the maintenance of a flight school airplane, but at least understand what's going on with oil changes and annuals and how to understand what that process looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. And a point I want to get to after that. So at our flight school, the maintenance shop is right by the flight line. The doors are always open. The students can walk through the hangar and see the mechanics working on it, and they're happy to demo and show what's going on there. We're doing 100 hours pretty much nonstop with 24 airplanes cycling through the system. And so that's encouraged there. I know not every airport's like that. They don't have that kind of openness. But at a small county airport, we have that luxury. I do want to kind of come back to David and Dave's point. Let's assume the flight instructor knows what he's doing and he knows what's going on here. Let's assume best case scenario. He was waiting for the student to figure this out. And he put it back on the student and said, what are you going to do? That's a great teaching opportunity for the student to make the decision. They're going to remember that for the rest of their life. I'm not going to push through if I see something that's not right. Clearly, the student doesn't know. The instructor's testing that student. The student made the decision on their own to divert, and I think it's just a great opportunity for a learning point. So if we do think that way, let's give the instructor some credit, maybe, and he really made a difference in that student's training.
Wally.
I'd just like to take the other position on that, Brett. That's a wonderful thought you have, but I have the feeling that this instructor hasn't been trained in the engine analyzer very well either, because he didn't understand even how to do a lean find. And so he's taking this opportunity to learn a little while he's bored flying cross country, which to me tells me the instructor probably wasn't properly checked out and trained to do his job in the beginning.
And there may be even a chance to teach a little bit of CRM here, even if the instructor's not sure. Maybe we won't have a great lesson in engine diagnostics, Colleen, but could we at least teach a little bit about working together to work in an abnormal situation?
Yeah, on the subject of how to learn more about your engine monitor and become friends with it, if you've got time on a cross country, I don't know if it's discouraged by flight schools, but I would recommend doing an in-flight lean check to see how the engine monitor responds as you lean the engine. I know some flight schools don't like you to fly lean and peak. I highly recommend it. It's good for your engine, and it's not going to hurt it if you're, not making a lot of power and zorching around on the deck. There are certain rules for altitude and percent power where you want to do this. But generally, when you lean the engine, you lean it to the point of roughness and then back, and you should watch what the EGTs are doing. And when you do that with a recording engine monitor, you can download that data, and then you can learn about the spread between the peaks on all the cylinders. You can see a lot of things. There are some in-flight checks that you can do that tell you about the health of your engine, and it's like going to get a blood test every 6 months. It's a great thing to do before an annual inspection. Collect some data on your engine and provide that to your mechanic, and hopefully he knows what to do with it.
Do you get a blood test every 6 months?
No. Okay.
It's amazing to think in this scenario, in an older airplane with just a single needle EGT, would anybody think we would know anything was wrong, or would we be just happily trucking along over North Dakota?
Wait till it smells bad.
Yeah, nodding head. So this is a case where having more information can make you nervous, but in a helpful way, because we're going to identify a problem here before it becomes a really catastrophic one, which is a good thing. David?
It should be reiterated what Wally said. They are flying in an extremely inhospitable environment. When I learned to fly in Montreal in the winter, there was this knob on the panel, the 150, that said cabin heat, but I was pretty sure it wasn't connected to anything. So you need to... Flight planning for this means that if the bad thing happens, if you have the really bad day, you need to be prepared for it. So that's really the first part of dealing with this emergency. Second one is I had a engine failure in a Navajo, and I had a choice of climbing from sea level to 9,000 feet and going 100 miles over the rocks on one engine, or NDB circle the land below minimums. And that's what I did. So I circled the land at 300 AGL on one engine, because that was the only choice. Turned out two other pilots had put a total of 4 liters of oil in the engine in the last 6 hours and didn't think that they should tell anybody. So needless to say, we had a conversation that was all transmit on my part and all receive on theirs. But, it was shocking to me. This engine failure was preventable because people did not understand that when engines start drinking oil, it's bad. always bad. So there's some kind of absolutes, and my final comment is nobody looks at the belly of an airplane. And you know what? If you're on a rental airplane and there's fresh oil in the belly, you should ask some skill testing questions.
Dave.
I was just reminded of a presentation by Doug Rosendahl I recently attended, and it was provocatively titled, "Who's Preparing for an Accident?" And obviously it's like, well, none of us are planning to crash. You know, the answer should be nobody, right? But it comes right back to Wally's point about the inhospitability and the difficult survivability of of an off-field landing in a hostile environment like North Dakota in the winter toward evening. And I think it may be on the web, but I just encourage you to look at that, because it was very thought-provoking, and it was, you know, the moral of the story was we should all be preparing for an accident. You know, it's like it could happen to any of us, and you know, wouldn't it be a shame to, you know, survive the off-field landing just to die of exposure?
I think the moral of this story in this case is certainly that. Be prepared for the off-field landing. Be prepared for diversion. That means more than just runway, but facilities. But the biggest one is get involved in at least understanding the engine operation for your airplane. If you're a student pilot or even a private pilot and have not used that lean assist page or have not looked at what the CHT means, great time to get a flight instructor to explain what that means and see if you can detect these signs before it's too late.